Hi, John.
Hey, Tarek.
We've got a guest today.
No way.
Someone very special. Today, we've got the Lex Roman joining us.
Whoa, that's amazing. That's great. I guess, Lex, are you up in San Francisco?
I am. I'm just a room away from Tarek.
We're in separate rooms recording this, like literally separated by a wall.
We should get some closets set up in the office so that when we have guests, they can actually be in like a closet filled with people's clothes and things like that. That would be perfect.
It is strange recording when I don't see clothes and laundry because we record in our closet so often late at night. Oftentimes I'm making like a laundry strategy as I'm recording this podcast. So I do miss that. So Lex is joining us all the way from Los Angeles up here in San Francisco. She works at the Black Tux. She's kind of, you know, a big thought leader in the space for growth design. She's been here this past week speaking at a growth design speaking series. And other than growth design, she's just a very cool person. She's involved in homeless initiatives in LA, and she seems to have a really cool family that does interesting trips. So how was that as an intro, Lex?
That was a pretty great intro. I'm a big fan of both of yours too. So I'm excited to be talking with you.
Wow, we could just do an episode just where I had a tough morning, you know, like the kid coordination was very difficult. And so we could also just do an episode. I failed basically in my efforts. So we could just talk about how great everything is and that would make me feel better.
Yeah.
I believe they call that success theater.
I was going to say.
Yeah. But you know, sometimes you just need a distraction, I think.
John, what you need is there's a bathroom at the Swell office where they just write affirmations on the mirror. That's what you need today.
I could do that at my house.
I think there's a startup there where it's just kind of this smart frame that just writes positive affirmations for your washroom.
It'd be like a positive version of Twitter, but then projected into your bathroom.
Right.
But right. We know Twitter's not like that. So, okay. All right, now I'm bummed out again about like world affairs. But let's talk about, yeah, speaking of failure.
that is a great segue into our topic for today, which is really around failure and success and why that's hard to share, why that's hard to talk about in an organization, and how it can be helpful if you know how to tackle it. So, you know, Lex, you work a lot in growth design. A huge aspect of growth design is talking about wins and losses. What do you think about just sharing failure at work?
It's not easy to share failure at work because your job is to succeed. So it's challenging because you're hired to help your company be successful. And so it takes a special kind of company and a special kind of team to understand that failure is part of success.
Do you find you've found those teams in your career? And if you have, what has been the difference in what they do?
Not always. So I used to work with clients. When I was living up here in San Francisco, I worked with clients. And clients are not into failure. So definitely working in-house, it's a lot easier to get that alignment. But it's also that everyone in a team comes in with a different awareness of that. Like, I find that experimentation is still pretty nascent for startups and growth companies, and the maturity around like how you learn and how much rigor you have around a test, it varies by person. So as everyone joins a company, you're getting different levels of that, and you have to level set that on every team. And it's really hard. I think the level of investment in some things is hard. Like if you've invested, like DJ and I at Black Tux, we invested probably a month of development time on this test that we thought was going to crush. We were so confident it was going to crush. We both said we would jump off a cliff if it didn't crush. And then it failed within a day. It had like, it tanked conversion. It tanked so hard. It was awful. And it was really a tough pill to swallow. And engineering was not super thrilled about that. And so what we did there was really invest in understanding what happened. And I think that's a way you can recover, is the gain there is the learning, is what you're going to do next.
You know, I find that so interesting because oftentimes when people talk about failure, they're perhaps not a company that does a lot of experimentation. And so I've always had this impression that if a failure is really hard, maybe you're not taking as many shots at bat. But, you know, when you mentioned Black Tux, you guys do a lot of experiments. You guys are very data-driven. So to hear that it's even difficult for you, I think, is almost kind of humbling in a certain way. Like no matter how much you value learning, it's still hard when a test fails.
Yeah, and I think that's a thing I always look for in someone who's going to join the team is an awareness that it's really not clear. Like data does not speak for itself.
Yeah, there was an article shared about Netflix and how for their experiments, they only keep 4 out of 10 of them. So most of the time, you know, their ideas aren't working out. And that was, to me, a bit surprising because Netflix is kind of the best in the business in this, right? They've got high quality designers. They're very data driven. So even for them, if best is 4 out of 10, it really puts things into perspective.
Like 4 out of 10 and Netflix, 4 out of 10 winners sounds high to me. I wish that was our rate of success.
I don't even think they were talking about ground level A/B experiments for, you know, this treatment or that treatment. I think he was actually talking more on the strategic level, sort of the strategic bet level, like, okay, we're going to spend the next 3 to 6 months trying this out. And so you can imagine even like the number of failed experiments beneath that.
Right.
It's kind of incredible to think about it. It matches what I heard the other day that some paper, I'll try to find the link or ask the person who told me about it, uses a one-third rule that it's like 1 out of 3 things show any kind of positive lift. And then 1 out of 3 of those things. So 1 out of 3 out of 1 out of 3 actually are kind of like enough of a lift to really have justified that type of investment there. So 1 out of 3, that's pretty rough. That's hard to think about.
So how do you do it then? What do you guys think? What helps in kind of lessening the blow?
I'll use the experience I've had kind of working with startups when I was kind of involved in lean startup type stuff and consulting for a bit. And what was fascinating is that the worst people are founders of companies. Like they would embrace this lean startup idea. They'd be like, oh, it makes complete logical, rational sense that we would work that way. How would we work any other way? That's scientific. I'm a scientist, you know, or I studied science in school. Like we're going to do it that way. And literally the first kind of failed thing, they built a kind of reality force field. And then some would argue that founders need a reality force field because reality is so hard for startups that you need a level of blindness about what you're doing. You need a level of just determination. You kind of need to grin and work through it. But one thing that I think you kind of alluded to this before, Tarek, was that I think kind of talking ahead of time about an effort and acknowledging that there's a high chance that it won't work out and thinking about like the decisions that will come out of that, sort of preparing yourself ahead of time can go a really, really long way. So what I started to do in the consulting, instead of like talking about an experiment, everyone gets excited about it and then they all go out there and it kind of falls flat. We almost prepared ourselves from the beginning that there was a very, very low probability that it was going to work out, and then thought through the gameplay if that were to not work out. So it was almost like mentally preparing people for the idea that there was less of a chance it was going to work out.
Yeah, you need those guardrails from the beginning because data is only as good as people's internal beliefs, right? They're only willing to, as we know from world news, they're only willing to believe data that aligns with their beliefs. So you have to make sure the beliefs are aligned before you start. A couple things there. One is making sure that you have that holistic view in your plan. Like we're looking to move this, but we think it could also affect this. And here's where it might get complex, sort of trying to play forward what might happen. And then for me, including objective folks as part of the results, going to people outside the team to say, here's what we think this is saying.
Great point. Yeah, that sounds, yeah.
What teams are you talking about that you would go outside, like research teams or product teams?
I go to our CMO a lot because he's a close partner for the product team, but doesn't directly build any experiments. So he helps provide strategic direction. But when it comes to believing the results, he's pretty objective. I go to our head of data, who is a trusted resource too, and have her just take a look at the way I'm reading something. And then our product manager, Andrew, suggested that we just have people who didn't work on the test look at the analyze tests or look at the results.
One thing that that makes me think about, Tarek, is that one exercise that I do that has really seemed to work over the years is during that kickoff period when you're sort of tackling a new mission together, people usually have a pretty, like they're pretty optimistic. They've got a fresh kind of perspective. Trying to get the team at that point. So an exercise that I do is that I have them work on a kickoff deck that also makes forecasts about what they think will happen. You know, so they actually draw charts, they put charts in their deck or they use notebooks or whatever, and they actually indicate what they think will happen. And then they make a commitment then to share back that same deck at some later point in the future. So I think that what that does, thinking about what Lex said, is that I think it's sort of a debiasing, and it adds a little bit of safety because they're kind of agreeing at that point to revisit it. And thinking about what Lex said, what would be really interesting at that point is to like involve a third party when you're kicking it off. So they kind of like see what you're talking about. And then what better of a time than to invite them back when you're presenting back as kind of an unbiased observer in that thing. So I think that, you know, this is a hard one because people resist putting a stake in the ground when they are in a low safety environment. No one wants to make a forecast. No one wants to say what they think will happen. But being very clear about what you think might happen or expect to happen seems like one of the best ways to kind of be able to reflect in the future about whether what you thought would happen happened. So I don't know, that exercise has been something that's worked for me. It's kind of connecting the kickoff to a learning review in the future and putting a stake in the ground when you do your kickoff, that agreement that you'll do the sharing back can have a high impact, I think.
Do you feel like your team has high safety, like high psychological safety?
I don't know, Tarek, you take that one.
You know, that's an interesting question. I think in a lot of ways we do, but we're certainly not perfect. When I think about safety, I think about ways people feel in all sorts of different circumstances, when they're trying something new, when they're suggesting ideas, the repercussions for failure. I don't think we're perfect, but there are certain things we do that certainly do help. Let me give an example. So, you know, John touched on setting those metrics ahead of time and setting a time to talk about them after, you know, something has released. Absolutely. That's something we try to do for all of our one pagers. Set out the metrics, set out what you think it'll move ahead of time. Sometimes that's a specific number. Sometimes that's just a general feeling we say that we'll validate qualitatively. Something I found that really helps for that, especially if it's a big project. I'm thinking about, you know, the time we redid our navigation for Amplitude, which, you know, was a sprawling project that touched a lot of different teams. We actually made a brain trust. So we created this brain trust of people from customer success, from sales, from engineering, from marketing, and we would meet with them every week. And what it did was that it created a space where everybody felt like they were co-developing, co-designing together. They would get updates every week about where we were. And that in itself created a lot of psychological safety because it never felt like, okay, here's our thing. How do we share it with everyone? Well, we already had somebody from every team kind of already doing that for us. And so to answer your question about that safety, you know, I do think we have aspects of it, and we've done things like these brain trusts that kind of set yourself up for success, for safety. But no, I do imagine there are things we can improve and there are blind spots. What do you guys think about when you think about safety around failure?
Well, I think it's really hard for a team to admit failure if they don't feel secure about their jobs. Like that is, I think, a foundational consideration. If you feel like you could be fired, then you are less likely to admit failure or challenges, right?
Safety question is really interesting because some people assume that it means that, you know, there's no conflict, or some people assume that means that you can, you know, I have every right to be a jerk because then my team will accept me being a jerk. You know, like I've heard it incorporated some ways in that way, which is kind of a weird thing. But I think that, you know, often this starts at the very top. And, you know, I'm kind of more of like a flat organization kind of person. I thrive better in those situations. But the power of a leader in the company, you know, either a formal or informal leader in the company, talking about something that they thought was going to work out and didn't work out the way they expected it would work out, just has an absolutely transformative effect on everyone. And I think it kind of relates to Lex's point. Like, if they can admit that that happened, then, and their job is safe, theoretically, then suddenly it sends the message to everyone else that their job is also safe to do that. I think one thing really plagues this question is when teams are forced to either get funding or get their project in queue or whatever, that it creates this kind of rose-colored glasses pitch culture in the company where the only way to quote-unquote get your stuff worked on or work on your special idea is to create such a level of confirmation bias and sunk cost bias that you'll never be able to admit that you failed. So I think a very actionable way to add kind of safety, it's more structural than it is kind of anything, is how you approach planning and how you approach budgeting your efforts actually has a profound impact on whether people can openly admit failure. So those are two things that come to mind that I think relate to psychological safety. The first one is very clear and common and almost cliche. You know, the leader needs to admit failure and make sure everyone's job is safe. The second one is a little bit more subtle, that you could have a highly psychologically safe environment, but if you promote pre-convergence on efforts to get funding and to get your stuff in queue and worked on, I remember working, doing consulting at a company where they had had something sitting in a list, in a backlog for 8 months with like a business owner ruminating over it. Like, how can I make progress on this? The team isn't working on it yet. Oh my God. And so after 8 months, there's no acknowledging that that thing's failed if it goes, you know, a team grabs it and tries to tackle it because they've already gotten too deep into it.
Oh, that's the worst. Oh my God. Nightmares. I worked at a company that was 3 years deep into a product that hadn't shipped. And like that thing was just going to tank so hard, but it still hasn't shipped. They're definitely going to spin it into a success no matter what, you know, because it's just like we've invested so much, our lives, right? 3 years of your life. It's crazy.
Yeah. One thing that also reminds me, I remember talking to a CPO or VP of product, and they said, you know, John, I get that we should talk about failure, but, you know, morale is important. And the only reason I'm mentioning that is that different people have different kind of tolerances for, you know, just tearing everything apart. And what I noticed in that company is, for example, there were some engineers who absolutely wanted everyone to tear everything apart. The phrase success theater so resonated with that team that they thought it was just stupid. Why would we ever try to frame the good news and not talk about all the crap that was happening? And then there was another contingent of people. I said engineers, but it actually wasn't related to functional roles. Just maybe just types of people, maybe, or just types of people at that company and how they were related to it. Other people had like a more middle of the road thing. So I think it's safe to say too that acknowledging failure doesn't mean you should be a jerk, right? And it doesn't mean that there's not a place for trying to find the good news in situations as well, I would think. What do you think, Tark?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've seen that a lot in my career here and there. It's, you know, there's so much to say about social contracts, communication styles. There's a lot of growing up, I think, especially the tech industry needs to do around just kind of basics of how people deal with each other that makes sharing failure that much harder. You know, I think tech, more than a lot of industries, they're not, you know, other industries aren't immune to it, but I think tech in particular has a lot of first-time managers that aren't often qualified to be first-time managers. So what you share really rings true for me and a lot of the things I've seen around just basics people need to do to just better manage people, better motivate one another. You know, I've had experiences working at a lot of different cultures. You know, one comes to mind at Amazon, where I worked for the Amazon Prime team, and another one where I worked for the Amazon Fresh team. And I had totally different managers for each one. For the Prime team, The manager knew how to motivate me, knew how to give me guidance in ways that would actually help me perform better. Where my manager at Amazon Fresh was someone who often used guilt as a motivator. Mm-hmm. And often that did produce results, but it certainly made it hard for me to share my failures. There'd be times where we would share our stand-ups. He would dig into things I haven't done. And we're spending 20 minutes with, you know, all my peers around me digging into why I didn't finish something. So that absolutely made me terrified about sharing any failure. So what you say really rings true for me. And I think a lot of it comes down to just sometimes basic management skills. What do you guys think? Am I being too hard on tech? Sometimes I feel like I am.
No.
I mean, if we lift out of tech, though, I was thinking for Lex, I'd be really interested because you kind of mobilize these sort of efforts in your community where it's just so hard, like you're pushing a ball uphill. So maybe just like, let's not talk about tech for a second. Like if you're in these like advocacy efforts, how is failure either dealt with differently or the same? And is it all the same everywhere or is it different?
Yeah, I think it depends on the stakes. Specifically in LA, our government is failing to end our homelessness crisis. And yet, every time the mayor speaks, he paints a rosy picture of how many units of housing were built and how many people got housed. So yeah, I mean, I think the government is especially bad at embracing that failure and recovering from it, which I think is partially why they don't improve as fast as maybe some of the private sector does. Yeah. And it's interesting. I saw this talk years ago from someone at NASA. The talk was titled, "Take Big Risks and Do Not Fail." And he basically talked all about how they just like that failure was not an option, which is interesting and not the way that I work. But there are some industries where I think, like I worked in the film industry. In the film industry, failure it's like a continuum. Like you're always producing stuff and it's just the metrics aren't as clear. So it's harder to say whether or not you succeeded or failed, I guess, unless your TV show gets canceled.
I think that's the same though as software as a service versus some types of products that you're like, you know, you're shipping like an 8-page app basically, right? Like with like 3 workflows in it. But when you're doing something like B2B SaaS and, you know, the product is this organism almost. You've birthed it and now it has to grow and it becomes like a like gangly teenager and then it like totally rebels and like runs away and stuff like that. And so I think that like certain products also lend themselves to different thoughts about failure. One thing Tarek, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it is that when we, you know, deal with kind of growth marketing teams, they've so kind of acclimated themselves to the idea that they like, oh, we're running like a landing page test and we know there's success and failure. It's binary. Right. But it's almost the binary nature of it makes those people much more sort of okay with it. Whereas the, you know, and a lot of times in B2B SaaS, the things that we're doing now might take, you know, months and quarters to mature. Right. And so I think that that's another part too. Like often this failure question, if people say, I'll tell you whether you succeeded or failed in 2 minutes and then you can go about your way, people be like, great, that sounds amazing. Right? Much harder is to be like, you know, a designer at a B2B SaaS company and have this gut discomfort over 1 or 2 quarters that maybe the bets you made 3 quarters ago haven't come to fruition. That's really hard. That's a hard feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of those kind of growth-driven, smaller A/B tests so much easier to do because you're running many more of them. So if some of them fail, that's okay. I think it also makes that function lead to some bad practices as well. People test a lot of ideas that aren't good ideas. You know, the ability to A/B test is not you testing an idea you like and think is good with an idea that's bad. It's about testing 2 equally good ideas that you don't know how it'll perform. Right. And so although it's better for sharing failure, there's actually less thought sometimes. Teams fall into traps of using A/B tests as ways to, you know, not settle a discussion or, yeah, let's try both of those ideas, right? So it does have a pro for the culture of failure, but that can actually directly lead to some cons for cultures of collaboration and cultures of, you know, putting deep work into things, et cetera.
I think Lex mentioned this too, very briefly, thinking that some teams, I think, just have complete trust issues and data becomes like a trust proxy. And if data is a trust proxy and you only want to make sure that you trust people, you're never going to be able to think about failure. because you're basically linking failure or lack thereof to trust. And of course, you're never going to do that. And so what I mean by data as a trust proxy is no one trusts each other, but they're like, you know, if we have the data, if you don't have data, get out of the room. It's my idea that, you know, there's this kind of like really aggressive language around the use of data. And it's all about navigating trust. And Silicon Valley can be terrible about this. It's like, we're a data-driven culture, basically means we don't trust each other. We only trust data for this thing. So I think that you have to kind of get rid of that. If data becomes a trust proxy, you're never going to be able to trust each other enough to admit that you failed.
And data is just made up. I mean, I can make you a chart that tells you you succeeded.
Right, exactly.
I can always manipulate that, right?
Yeah.
For sure. There's a lot more to talk about. I think, you know, just for the sake of time, I think there's a lot of helpful things we've touched on today. Lex, you know, if you could just summarize what you thought was interesting or helpful in this discussion, what would you say are your takeaways?
I think the trust issue is key. Understanding whether or not your team has trust and how to build that within your organization, that's how you really succeed. So for me, the trust issue is an important focus.
How about you, Tarek?
Yeah, absolutely. I think thinking about trust, I also liked what we said about psychological safety. That really spoke to me as well. Well, thank you again for joining us, Lex. It was a pleasure, and let's make sure we do this again.
Are we not going to do the desert island question? I want to weigh in on that.
Oh, Lex, you're talking about that kind of funny outro we've been trying to do.
Yeah, I love those.
Do you want to do one now?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Let me see. John, do you got anything?
I have one. It will be more experimental, but I think it could be okay. So here's my idea. My idea is that you have 60 seconds to describe everyone as a designer, assuming that you're speaking to like a 4 to 6 year old. And since you have young kids, like at least for Lex and I, you could impersonate the 4 to 6 year old. And because 4 to 6 year olds ask a lot of questions, right?
So, goodness.
Yeah, so this is pretty out there, but I think that we could get somewhere with it.
Okay, we're probably going to start a flame war on Twitter, no matter what we say.
But this is making it so, like, if we can't explain it to a 4 to 6 year old, then it's a non-topic. We shouldn't be talking about it on Twitter anyway.
Fair enough. Okay, so how do we do this?
So why doesn't Lex? So Lex will play the adult, and you will play the 4 to 6 year old, and you've got 60 seconds to explain everyone is a designer to a 4 to 6 year old.
Okay.
Okay. And then I get to ask questions as a 6 year old.
Yeah.
Okay,
because they're going to ask questions all the time, basically.
Should I make a voice? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. That's funny.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, Tommy, I just want to explain this idea that everyone's a designer. So, just think about everyone in the world.
Okay.
And think about that they all have ideas, right? They have great ideas.
I have ideas.
Yeah, exactly. You have ideas. I have ideas. And all of these ideas together can make the world better.
Okay.
And so that's the idea, that everyone can contribute to making the world better.
So why don't you call yourself an idea person?
Yeah, I mean, some people do. Some people call themselves ideators, I guess. Or strategists of some kind.
So if you're not a designer, you don't have any ideas.
That's a good point. But everyone has ideas. So that's the thing. Everyone has ideas. There's not a person that exists that doesn't have ideas.
Oh, okay. So designers only have good ideas.
No, not necessarily. Sometimes they have bad ideas. Yeah, so it's really about everyone learning how to vet those ideas and understand what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Oh, the product manager owns that.
We have to wait till you're at least 10 to understand what a product manager does, though. So,
so if everybody's a designer, does that mean designer is like being a human?
Yeah. I mean, designers are, it's really about being human. That's right. You really get it. I think you really have a future.
That's good. So 60 seconds. That was great.
Wow. Did you start a new
Twitter thread about this, John?
No, I mean, not while you guys were talking, but we could potentially do that in the future. I think, but we could get some ideas in the future from people. You know, Tarek, do you want to try it? And I'll be the 4 to 6 year old.
Oh my goodness. Again. Okay.
All right. Can you do product management though?
Okay, we'll do like explain product management to a 4 to 6 year old, and I will be the 4 to 6 year old, Tarek.
Okay. Okay. Let's do this.
Do I have to do the voice?
You need a different voice, John.
I would do it. Oh.
Hi. No, I can't do a different voice.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
I can't.
That's wow. I think acting, you could be an actor, John.
I gotta go pee. All right. Okay, Tarek, you can start now. Okay.
Okay. So, John.
Yes.
Let me tell you, today I want to teach you about product management. And what a product manager is. A product manager. Wait, let me try it this way. John, do you have toys?
Yeah, I have lots of toys.
Do you sometimes play with your toys and the toys play with each other?
Oh, my daddy buys the toys.
Now, have you noticed if you don't put the toy in the chair, it doesn't do anything?
I want my iPad.
Right. Sometimes you have to pick up your toys and you've got to get them in a room together. You've got to be the glue.
How does this have to do with being a PME? Yeah,
okay. I think at that point, I think if anyone's still listening, I think that... That's probably a good sign we stop.
Okay, that's a good thing. All right. Cool. I think there's something there. That's fine.
Yeah. All right. Well thank you.
This could become the trend though. Could it be like explain the difference between like UXD and I? Yeah, this could be really funny. I'm glad that we explored this.
Okay.
Too, so. All right.
This could be a thing.
I definitely want you to explain Jira to someone who's never seen it before.
I think we're gonna have to start. I think that this will warm people up. We'll ask some Twitter questions for this. Like, explain Jira to a 4 to 6 year old. Okay.
Yeah.
We have to put a character limit too. Let's see.
Well, that is a tweet.
Well, fair enough. You got me. Explain Twitter to me.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, on that note, thank you, Lex, for joining us. We always want feedback, so please send us any feedback. We've had some audio mic issues in the past. So if they haven't improved, please let us know. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. Thanks a lot, everyone. That's fine.
Thank you.
Goodbye.